Okay, I'm sorry, let me brief review what we said yesterday in case any questions have come up, because it's an extremely important idea, extremely fundamental idea, and then if things are clear, we'll go on. If not, I do want to discuss it, so make sure that it's understood. The question we were facing is a contradiction between God's knowledge and man's free will. In particular, God's foreknowledge, knowing the future, and man's free will. The correct formulation of the problem, we said, is this. To make a free decision seems to mean that you have choices, alternatives, at least two, each of which is open, possible, and you choose one, and you do that one because you chose it. Had you chosen the other one, you could have done the other one. Now, imagine that today I choose between A and B. I choose A. Now we reflect. Yesterday, God knew that I was going to choose A. Could I have chosen B? Was B really possible? Was B really open? Let's see. Choosing B today would contradict God's knowledge yesterday. Yesterday he knew I was going to choose A. Choosing B today would contradict that. But now God's knowledge is perfect. It's infallible. It's impossible for God's knowledge to be wrong. So, since if I really choose B today, I would be really contradicting his knowledge. If it were possible for me to choose B today, it would be possible to contradict his knowledge. Which means it would be possible that his knowledge is wrong. But it isn't possible that God's knowledge is wrong. God's knowledge is infallible. So B can't really be possible for me. Which means I wasn't really making a choice between two alternatives both of which are possible, because one of them isn't possible. That's the contradiction between free will and God's knowledge. That's what we said yesterday. That's step one. Is the question clear? Is the contradiction clear? Why it looks like a contradiction? I mean, there are answers. I'm going to say one answer, right? There are at least four different answers, but it looks like a contradiction, right? Okay. Now, the answer we said yesterday in the name of Saramba, Maimonides, is this. When your problem is that you have a contradiction between A and B, if you give up A, then you won't have a problem. So, our response, this response to the problem, I won't call it a solution, I'd rather call it a dissolution, where you dissolve the problem. The response is to say, we're not going to assert that God knows. We're going to give that up. Of course, the worry then is that you're not doing Judaism, you know, you're off doing something else. If we give up God's knowing, are we then admitting that God could be ignorant? So here's the way the move is made. We give up talking about God altogether. We don't talk about God, period. We don't say anything about God. So we don't say he knows, and we don't say he's ignorant, because ignorant is another thing said about God. We don't say he knows, we don't say he doesn't know. As I said yesterday, we learned to do something very un-Jewish. We learned to keep quiet. Just don't say anything. Because God is beyond all description, all thought, all conception. They're called transcendent. And therefore, nothing we say about God is right. Nothing we say about God is true. So, if we're not going to say that He knows, then you can't raise the question, how could our free will be compatible with His knowledge? Because we're not going to say that He knows. What do we do with the hundreds and hundreds of descriptions of God that you find in the Tanakh, in the Midrash, in the Talmud, in the Siddur, and other places in Jewish literature? There are hundreds and hundreds of descriptions of God. The answer is that they are not descriptions of what God is, they're descriptions of what God does. Things happen in the world. We can describe those things that happen. We can describe their patterns. We can describe their goals, their tendencies. But all we're talking about are the things that happen in the world. We're not talking about the agency behind them. We're talking about what He does, not about what He is. So, when you have a description that looks like it describes what God is, what you have to do is translate. Translate it into a description of what He does. And the way you do that is you use the following kind of pattern. You read, God is X. So you think, let's see. Let's pretend for a minute that it were true. God is X. Now, being X, what would He do? You say, well, let's see. Someone who's X would do A, do B, do C. Those are the kinds of things that someone who is X would really do. Good. Now just subtract the X. And retain the A, B, and C. Because He isn't really X. From our point of view, there's nothing we can say He really is. So you put the X in sort of as a fantasy, and you use it as an axiom. If He were really X, what would He do? You deduce what He would do, then of course you subtract the axiom, but that was only a fantasy. He isn't really anything that we can say. But you retain the things that He would do. And that way you can translate all of the descriptions that look like the descriptions of what God is into descriptions of what He does. And I told you that this is found in Kabbalistic literature and in the philosophical literature, that God is beyond all literal description, is something that all Jewish sources and all streams of Jewish thought agree upon. And it wasn't invented for the sake of foreknowledge of free will. This principle has independent sources, which happens to be very useful when you come to the problem of foreknowledge of free will. So, if you say God is just, that will mean that the righteous will be paid for their righteous deeds, and the wicked eventually will be punished for their wicked deeds, and the reward of punishment will be appropriate for the actions that were performed, because that's what a righteous being would do, a just being would do. So now, just take the description of what will happen to the righteous people, what will happen to the wicked people, and subtract the idea that God is just. Just talk about what will happen. And that's how it goes for every proposed description of God. For knowledge, to say God knows, is omniscient, I suggested yesterday, the translation will be, ask yourself, what would an omniscient being do? Well, whenever you perform an action, you perform the action in terms of the context, in terms of its relationships to other things. An omniscient being would take account of every other item so that what he does is appropriately related to everything else. That's what an omniscient being would do. Good. Now just subtract omniscience and retain the description of the actions. Everything that happens in the world that God does in the world is appropriately related to everything else that happens. But not because of omniscience. Because that we can't say. We can't describe God at all. And that being the case, we're not saying that God knows, and we don't say that God knows, then there's no contradiction between his knowledge and free will, because we're not saying he has knowledge. That's what we said yesterday. Is everybody satisfied with that? Okay, that's a very radical way of solving the problem. There are other ways, each with its own twist, each with its own subtlety, which also are used to solve the problems. One, which a few sources talk about, is this. Let's say we can describe God. We can say lots of things about God. And we can talk about his knowledge. But remember that God is outside of time. From a Jewish point of view, time is a creation. By the way, in cosmology, this is also correct. Time is a feature of the world. It doesn't exist independently of the world. And since God is not located within the world, he's not located within time either. And by the way, having this in your mental back pocket will help you know how to respond to the often asked question, what was God doing before the creation? It's really clever, you could put it, I think, where Leibniz said, how did God choose the moment of creation out of the infinity of moments before creation, all of which are the same? After all, God should have a reason for doing things. And since they're all the same, what reason could he possibly have had for choosing this moment rather than that moment? Now, given what I told you, the correct response is?
There are no moments.
There is no time. Time is a created thing. And therefore, before the creation, is a simple contradiction. I'll give you Stephen Hawking's example of this kind of contradiction. Exactly where is 5 miles due north of the North Pole? Where is that? Well, as Hawking points out, if you stay at the North Pole, wherever you go is south. There's no way to go north from the North Pole. So 5 miles north of the North Pole is just a lack of understanding what the North Pole is. Similarly, before the creation is a lack of understanding that time is part of the creation. Before the creation is nonsense. Okay, so God is outside of time. Now, this problem, the problem of foreknowledge and free will, that syllable "for" isn't a joke. It isn't dispensable. It's crucial that it be foreknowledge. The knowledge comes before the decision. If the knowledge isn't before the decision, you can't generate a problem. Let's try. How did the problem go? I'm sitting here today. I have A and B in front of me. I think both of them are open. God knew already yesterday I was going to do A, so that when I think about B, B isn't really open. Because if I do B now, I'm going to contradict his knowledge yesterday that's already on the books. I'm contradicting it. It's going to be a historical fact. But now, if God's outside of time, so then we won't say he knew yesterday. Because he's outside of time. I can't put a time on his knowledge. All I can say is, he knows. Or better, because verbs in English always are tensed. Yes, and then you can ask, he knows, when is that? And then you get these scriptures like this. For God, the past, present, future are all present. Which doesn't mean anything at all. That's not even poetry. That's just nonsense. Would you say for God, north, east, south, and west are all in the same place? That wouldn't make sense, would it? Not even for God. They can't all be in the same place. Past, present, and future can't be all present. It's just out of contradiction. So the best way to do this, I believe, is to start talking with nouns and not verbs. God's knowledge includes all facts. Includes everything. Now, among other things, God's knowledge includes that on this occasion, I did A. Would that mean that B wasn't open, wasn't possible? His knowledge includes what I did. It doesn't say anything about what other things I could have done. To stop what I could have done, you've got to have knowledge yesterday. Once you put God outside of time, you refuse to apply time to God, then you refuse to apply time to God's knowledge, you can also stop the problem. The problem can't get started. You haven't got a contradiction anymore. Of course, what do you mean you don't apply time to God? Don't we apply time to God? I mean, don't we say that God spoke to Moses 3,300 years ago? Well, the answer to that is easy, right? Because that's a relationship between God and something in the world. A relationship between God and something in the world can be dated by dating the thing in the world. That's not so terrible. When you're talking about God's knowledge, you're talking about Him. You're not relating Him to something in the world. It's not an interaction between Him and something in the world. That you can't think. That's the second solution. It's another way, it's the same type of solution. You can't say the knowledge, which would get you into trouble. First way is very radical. You can't say anything. Second way is much more limited. You can say lots of things. You just can't put a date on it. In most cases, you can't say the knowledge claim that would have seemed to conflict with free will. You with me? Now, several people, I'm sure, one of the two people yesterday already started to express it, want to solve it another way, which you do have in certain Jewish sources. Yes, God knows. And yes, you can put it in time. And He knew yesterday. And even so, B is still possible. Even though it doesn't seem possible, because if it's possible to do B, then it's possible that his knowledge is wrong. And that's not possible. No, even so, it's possible. How could that be? Because it's my choice that causes his knowledge. And in effect, doesn't put any limitations on its cause. We didn't ask how God knows. We just took it for granted. He knows. And He's perfect. The knowledge is absolute. This solution says the way God gets His knowledge is as an effect of our actions. We lose in three stages. Stage one, you can think of God as tracking the world. In fact, you can think of God as omnipresent. That is to say, He's everywhere. He saturates everything. His presence applies to every item that exists. Omnipresent. Just as a footnote, notice, I didn't say that everything's part of God. You hear people talk like that, I hope they don't mean what they say. It is not correct to say that part of God is wood and part of God is marble, and when you burn a table, you're burning part of God, and God turns to ash, so forth and so on. Maybe that's other religions, but that's not Judaism. We don't talk like that. God is present everywhere. His will sustains everything. But God is not wood. But He's present everywhere. So everything that happens, He's present in the thing that happens. He's present. So of course God knows everything that happens. Most of the things that happen, He makes happen. He knows it because He makes it happen. Some of the things that happen, happen because we make them happen. He knows they happen because He's present in them. Okay, that's stage one. But now we have to get His knowledge yesterday. How do we do that? Now here's how you do it. Imagine a timeline. Here's the world at a time. Every point is of the whole world at a time. The past, the future. So here I am here today. Choose between A and B. I choose A. And God is here. He's in that dot. His presence fills the whole of the world at that time. So of course, at that dot, when I choose A, He's there. And He knows it. But God is more than just what fills the world. God also transcends the world. He creates the world. So he's above and beyond the world in addition to filling the world. He's both transcendent and immanent. So in addition to God saturating the world, being at every point on the line, God is also above the line, outside the line. So now, God is here at this point, saturating the world, where I make my choices in anything. So since he's present in that choice, of course, he knows about that choice. But then, since he's above the line, he also has knowledge above time of my choice of it. That's step two. Can you guess what step three is? If he has knowledge above the line, then that knowledge is now available to all the other points on the line. Because that's God also. God is at all the points on the line. So, from here, where he's above time, outside of time, the knowledge is available to all the other points on the line, past and future. That's how he knows yesterday what I do today. He knows because of the three-stage process. Stage one, today, when I make the choice, he's present in the choice, and he knows. Stage two, because he is beyond time, the knowledge is available above time. Stage three, the knowledge being available above time, that knowledge is now available to all the other points on the line. It means my choice today causes him to know yesterday. Of course, that may sound a bit strange. My choice today causes him to know yesterday? Gosh, is that possible? Cause and effect, where the effect comes first and the cause comes later? How exactly could that be? This is what's called the philosophy of backwards causation. Cause is today and the effect is yesterday. Can we accept that? Isn't that just absurd? You know, nonsensical? Contradictory? I want to let you in on two interesting pieces of information. Number one, philosophers have been trying for hundreds of years to prove that cause always comes before the effect, and they have not succeeded. No one has produced an acceptable argument that the cause has to come before the effect. I know it sounds like that to everyone. It seems obvious. But when you try to pin it down and prove it, no one's been successful in doing it. Okay, it's true. I don't think it's very important, because how much purchase does philosophy have anyway? But now let's look at physics. There are very eminent physicists who say that there are cases where the cause comes after the effect in our world. It actually happens in our physical world. One of them was Richard Feynman. Won a Nobel Prize in physics, so I guess he wasn't exactly dumb. And I guess he knew physics pretty well. And in his book, QED, which stands for Quantum Electrodynamics, he has an example of a particle interaction in which the effect comes before the cause. John Archibald Wheeler also says that there are such events that take place in the world. He's also one of the world's greatest physicists. So, if you have this intuition that the cause has to come first and the effect must come second, I suggest to you that philosophy can't confirm it. And physics says it's wrong, because actually there are cases where it doesn't happen like that. That being the case, I don't think we have to be embarrassed by saying that the picture we gave is a picture where my decision today causes God to know yesterday. Indeed, physics is a very limited domain. You're talking about within the physical world, within physical law. We're talking about our relationship between the world and God. There's a lot more freedom in explaining how the world relates to God than explaining how particle interactions take place in the laboratory. So this is the third solution. My decision causes God to know. Now, if my decision causes God to know, then his knowledge can't put any limitations on my decision, because an effect can't put limitations on its cause. The reason we thought we had a problem is because we thought that God's knowledge yesterday was independent of me. If God's knowledge is independent of me, then my choice has to live up to the facts built into that knowledge. But if my choice causes his knowledge, then his knowledge can't put any limitations on my choice. That's the third solution. Yeah.
The
answer is right on the surface. We are saying God knew in the past. We are saying he knew. So what's the problem about knowing the future? We are saying he knows the future. There is knowledge of the future. Now the question is where it comes from. But there is knowledge of the future. So Binyamin knew, of course he knew. Why not? God has that knowledge. He could share that knowledge with a person. We're explaining how there is knowledge of the future and still you have free will. And you're asking, but how can there be knowledge of the future? That's what I'm explaining. Okay, that's the third solution. There's a fourth solution, which I'll share with you because it's based on certain contemporary philosophy. The philosopher who thought up these things, I'm sure, is horrified to know that it's being used this way, because he doesn't share our orientation. But it is usable this way, and actually, I've been using it for years and years. It actually came out in print about a year ago. I was happy to see that one professor of philosophy did actually write it up this way. And this, somebody said yesterday, I think this was you. You started us down this road yesterday, and now I'm going to fill it out. The whole problem was built by saying a free choice is a choice between A and B, and God's knowledge cuts off B. The one I didn't do. And then we say, well, but you know, then you didn't choose between two alternatives. What kind of choice is it if you only have one alternative? There's a contemporary philosopher named Harry Frankfurt who suggests that when you are trying to understand why people are responsible for what they did, don't look at the other things they could have done. Don't look at that. You're looking in the wrong corner. That's not the right subject. Look at how they did what they did. Don't look at what they could have done, but look at what they did. And ask, did anything force them to act as they did? Was any force applied to them? Any push? Any power applied to them? Or were they left alone? If they weren't pushed, if they weren't forced, if they were left alone, then they're responsible, even if they couldn't have done something else. I don't care that they don't have any alternatives. What I care about is that what they did without being pushed and without being forced. I'll give you some examples of this to show you how to understand it. Actually, the original example goes back to John Locke, 350 years ago. I'll just jazz it up a little bit, but it's his example. I have promised to meet you downtown at 5:30. In order to do that, I leave my house at 5 o'clock. But I'm halfway through an absolutely absorbing, riveting book on quantum mechanics by David Albert, published by Harvard. I can't put it down. I've got to read this to the end, you know, find out how it comes out at the end. And it's getting closer and closer to 5 o'clock. I know I promised you. 5 to 5. How's the chapter going to end? It's 5:02. I could still make it if I run. 5:04. I'm not going. That's it. I'm going to finish the book. I can't help it. I'm not going. Good. I sit and read till 6:30. Wow. That's how it ends. Oh, boy. What a terrific book. Right? Of course, I feel a certain pang of guilt. I welched on the appointment. You know, I didn't come to meet you. Now, I go over to my front door. And I turn the handle and pull. And it doesn't open. Pull harder. give it a kick, it's stuck. I don't have a back door. I only have a front door. And it's stuck. And I do a bang and a kick and, you know, throw my body against it. Nothing moves it. I call the fire department. It turns out that it has been glued shut with molecular glue. It takes them an hour and a half to cut me out of that house. Good. Now I think back. Let's suppose that I had one struggle with my Yetzer Hara, my evil inclination. And at 2 minutes to five, I had put down the book and decided to come and meet you. What would have happened? Well, I would have gone to the door, turned the handle, and pulled, and it wouldn't have opened. And indeed, had I called the fire department on the spot, I wouldn't be able to get out till 6:30, and I wouldn't have met you anyhow. Meeting you wasn't an option. Meeting you wasn't an option. It wasn't in the cards. It wasn't going to happen no matter what. So can I now say, oh ho, so I couldn't have met you anyway. So I'm not guilty for failing to keep the appointment? I don't think we want to say that. What we want to say is that I failed to keep the appointment because of my own decision. That makes me guilty. True, I couldn't have met you anyhow, but that's not an excuse. Because, and now here's the principle, an excuse only works if it's the excuse that caused the failure. But if there's an excuse and the excuse didn't cause the failure was caused by a pre-decision without the excuse, then the excuse does not relieve responsibility. This is John Locke's example. Now let me give you Rabbi Hanan Wasserman's example, which is even closer. There, at least I made a free choice. It's a little closer. Now, to be Frankfurt's example, which tidies up some philosophical loose ends. I have decided to steal Peter's wallet. I know every day at 5 o'clock he walks past this corner. I know that Friday he gets paid. And I have my gun. It's Friday afternoon, 4:58. I'm ready to go. Suddenly, I feel a gun at my head, and somebody says to me, Peter's walking by in 2 minutes. Steal his wallet, or I'm going to blow out your brains. I say, would you repeat that? I don't get it. What did you say? He says, steal his wallet, I'm going to blow out your brains. So I say, well, okay, let me let you know a secret. That's what I'm here for. You know, that was my plan. I'm here to steal his wallet anyhow. You know, you can put away the gun. It's going to happen anyhow. He says, shut up, steal his wallet, I blow out your brain. He's got one track mind. He's got one song, and that's it. Good, good, okay, fine, watch. Right. Peter comes by, I steal his wallet, I go my way, the guy with the gun goes the other way, and that's the end of the story. Now they catch me. You stole Peter's wallet. You're a criminal, a bum. And I say, you don't understand. It's a guy who had a gun to my head, you know. He's going to kill me if I didn't steal Pete's wallet. I'm not guilty. Says Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, that's not an excuse. Why? For the same reason. Because it isn't the excuse that caused me to do what I did. It isn't because the guy had a gun to my head that I stole Peter's wallet. Had the guy with a gun never showed up, I would have stolen his wallet anyhow. I stole his wallet because of my own free decision. I couldn't have done anything else. Couldn't, in the sense that there was nothing available for me to do, nothing appropriate for me to do. You have to die to protect his wallet. Correct! I couldn't have done anything else. Doesn't matter. Because nothing caused me to decide and carry it out. The gun on my head is just icing. It was just icing. Without the gun, I would have done it anyhow. Now, Frankfurt wants to concoct an example where even the decision isn't in your hands. And here's how he does it. Peter wants George at 10 a.m. Friday morning to tie his shoelaces. Peter really wants this. He wants it so badly that Wednesday night, Peter and his good friend, the neurosurgeon, sneak into George's bedroom. And they anesthetize him. And the neurosurgeon opens up his brain and implants a device which can receive shortwave radio signals and is connected to various neurons in his brain, so that if Peter will send out the right signal, it will activate that device in George's brain and send the signals to the appropriate neurons, which will cause him to decide to tie his shoelaces. This is pretending the decisions are in the brain. We'll pretend that for now. Actually, there's no good reason to think that, but okay, let's pretend it for the sake of the example. That's where Frankfurt is holding anyway. Good! So it's all set up! Friday morning, all Peter has to do is press the button at 10 o'clock, signal will be sent, the device will be activated, and George will decide to tie his shoes and tie his shoes. There's only one hitch. The signal is very, very complicated. It takes a Cray 16 super duper computer to send out this signal, and it costs $100,000. Peter would like to save the money if he could. And the truth is that from time to time, George ties his shoelaces. I don't know. You know, without devices in his brain. He just spontaneously ties his shoelaces. So, what Peter has done is this. He set up a surveillance system to watch George. Now, it comes 10 o'clock Friday evening, Friday morning. If Peter is very, very lucky, George will spontaneously tie his shoes, and then he doesn't have to press the button, and he saves $100,000. If he's unlucky, and George is strolling along, you know, watching the birds, whistling a tune, then, with a sigh in his heart, Peter will press the button, and the thing will be activated, and George will decide to tie his shoes. Okay, now, tell me. What is George going to do at 10 o'clock Friday morning? He's definitely going to tie his shoes. He's definitely going to decide to tie his shoes. Definitely. We just don't know how. Either on his own or through Peter pressing the button. Okay, now here's what really happens. What really happens is Peter's watching the cameras of the surveillance system. George is going. It's 9:59. You know? Look at that. He stopped. He's putting his foot up on the wall. He's leaning down. He's taking the stick in his head. He's tying the shoes. Wow! He called the secretary. Make the tickets for Acapulco. You know, they got $100,000. He never presses the button. He's lucky. Is George responsible for tying his shoes? I mean, Peter didn't do anything. He didn't do anything. Peter didn't play any role in the way George tied his shoes. The button was there, but he never pressed it. So, George tied his shoes as if Peter had never been born. It seems obvious, says Frankfurt, it seems obvious that George is responsible for tying his shoes. Of course, because he tied his shoes without any interference whatsoever. Without any force applied to him, without any causation applied to him. He just did it on his own. Okay, what was his alternative? There was an alternative. Had he not decided on his own, then Peter would have pressed the button and he would have decided anyway. So says Frankfurt, what you see is that to be responsible for what you do, don't look at what other things you could have done. Look at how you did what you did. Don't go searching, you know, in the other guy's backyard. Talk about real history. Real history, not potential history, hypothetical history. What could he have done otherwise? Talk about real history. Look at what really happened. Did he do it on his own, or was he pushed? If he was pushed, then of course he's not responsible. If he wasn't pushed, then he's responsible. Now, of course, if you imagine another story in which Peter pushes the button, yes, if Peter pushes the button and it activates the device and it causes him to decide, then indeed, George will not be responsible. If he pushes the button. But we're talking about the story where he didn't push the button. Now, God's foreknowledge is just like Peter not pushing the button. Because, as we said, all God's foreknowledge does is cut out the thing he didn't do. That's in the other guy's yard. That's hypothetical history. That's potential history. That says nothing at all about how he did what he did. What he really did was to, well, I did in my case, was choose A. And there's no indication that God caused me to choose A, forced me to choose A, pushed me to choose A, that God applied any agency in my choosing A. Our only problem was God's knowledge yesterday makes B impossible. Okay, let's say it does. So what? B's, being there or not being there, is not what makes me responsible. What makes me responsible is I acted on my own. Acted on my own without any external push. Now, you may say, this is the end of this, you may say, but that's not really free choice. You know, that's free will. How can you say it's free choice if you're not making a choice? How can you say it's free choice if you didn't have two alternatives? So I think the way to handle it is this. Let's say it isn't free choice. Okay? Don't call it free choice. But he's responsible. Why did we want free will in the first place? Wasn't it free responsibility? What did the Rambam say yesterday? We wanted it before yesterday. Why? Because reward and punishment isn't relevant, isn't just without free will. Because the person is not responsible for what he does. So if you don't want to call it free will, I don't mind. I think that's a matter of semantics of free will. Okay, let's not say it's a free choice because there wasn't really a choice because there weren't two alternatives. But he's fully responsible for what he does. If he's responsible for what he does, then we have what we need out of it. I don't need any more than that. That's a fourth way to solve the problem. Yeah.
With regards to cause and effect, that possibly the effect can cause a coming forward. Isn't God the cause of everything? So he caused us to
Okay, glad you said that. I'm waiting for somebody to say that, but nobody said it, so we're on to the fourth solution. I'll put the problem in my terminology. If I don't get exactly what you want, then you'll come back again. The third solution says we cause God to know. Doesn't that create a kind of funny picture of God, that God is reactive? He's reactive. He's reactive. Doesn't that make him sort of dependent? Is that the appropriate way to describe God? Shouldn't he be totally independent and totally in control and making things happen, not reacting to things that happen? This is a really important point, because we are forced to describe God as reactive. It's built into the Torah's picture of the world, for sure. The Moshe Chaim Lutzato points this out in a couple of places. It's built into the Torah's picture for sure that God is reactive. One of the fundamental principles of faith, I shouldn't say that because I don't believe in faith. All right. Fundamental principles of Jewish thought paints God as supremely reactive. Which principle of Jewish thought is that?
Reward and punishment.
Reward and punishment. What does reward and punishment mean? I mean, if you do this, you get this response. If you do that, you get that response. It means the response you get depends upon what you do. So God is for sure reactive. He set it up that way. He set it up that he will be reactive. Gigantically reactive with respect to human beings. Well, he set it up that way to use an element, another element in that reactivity to human beings. I don't think it's going to be philosophically so objectionable. Once you see that he set up the creation to be reactive to human beings.
We have choice A and B. God knows we're going to choose A, therefore B is not really a solution, because if we do choose B, then that means that that God was wrong in saying that we were going to choose A.
That was the problem.
But we see many times in the Bible, not many times, but a few times in the Bible, where it shows that as if God was wrong or didn't know something was going to happen. For example, it says that the ground rebelled against God. It also said that he made a mistake. He says himself, I made a mistake by creating man. I'm going to wipe him out. I'm going to do it again. That's two examples right there where he's saying, I screwed up. I didn't know what I was doing.
Okay,
so there is an option of him. The Bible leaves us the option of saying that God leaves the possibility for things going astray.
Well,
something like that.
You could form that impression if you take one or two sentences out of the 1,000 pages of the Bible and read them in isolation. You could indeed get that impression. But there are other passages in the Bible which indicate the exact opposite. That very word that's used there, that God was nicham, he was thought better, so to speak, of what he did. There's another passage that says God is not like man to retract or think better of what he does. It's a direct contradiction. Something will have to be said about that. Now, the case of the earth is not so difficult, because there it doesn't say that he didn't know. He gave a command, the earth didn't fulfill it. It could very well be that he knew beforehand that he wouldn't fulfill it. But you should have raised, which the academics raised, what about the case where God asks questions? God says to Adam, "Where are you?" And Adam says, "I'm hiding over here." And then God says, "Did you eat from the tree?" Now, the naive academic, that might be redundant, says, "Well, God's asking him if he ate from the tree, so it must be clear that he doesn't know that he ate from the tree." Right. But if the academic has the strength to turn about 4 or 5 pages, he will read that God asks Cain, "Where is Abel your brother?" And Cain says, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And God says to him, "The blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground." Which means, does God know that Cain killed Abel? Yeah, he knows, and he asks anyway. Which means that God will ask questions even when he knows the answer. When you put it that way, it's kind of trivial, isn't it? Don't we all do that? Don't we all ask questions when we know the answer? We do it for educational purposes. We do it for emphasis. "Didn't I tell you yesterday?" I don't mean, "Gosh, did I tell you? I can't remember. Please remind me. Did I say?" What I mean is, I told you, but I'm asking you as a question. So this idea that you can find passages which God doesn't know is, if you take the whole of the Bible as your subject, you'll see that it can't be defended. In this case, of where it gets to God, regretted or regretted. What you'll find is that this concept of regret applies only to means and never to ends. And God will switch means, because he's not committed to the means, he's not committed to the ends. And that's how they divide up. When it says, I regret this and I'm going to do that, what it means is, I use this means, and now if this means doesn't work, I'll use that means. And it doesn't work because it's dependent upon free will, human free will. And in free will, God is reactive, as we said. Right, that's built in. So it's just an expression of the reactivity to human free will. Okay, but reactivity is a philosophical jolt. People say, how can you paint God as having his knowledge caused by what we do? That means his knowledge is a reaction to what we do. But that's true, because God's reactivity to human free choice is built into the system without avoiding. There's no way to avoid. Okay, those are the ways that we take care of it. There are 4 solutions to one problem. Any problem for which you have 4 solutions is not a problem over which you lose much sleep.